Good morning. This is Radio Region, and this is Saturday Morning Live. We're heard here streaming live to you every Saturday, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. We're going to go right into it. We have a packed up show. We're going to go right into Mamiya Abu-Jamal, and then we will have Norman Otis Richmond's Diasporic Music. Enjoy.
What it means, what it doesn't. For the second time in American history, a black man takes the office of U.S. president, a fact not thought possible just a few years ago. The re-election of Barack Hussein Obama to the nation's highest office is indeed a watershed moment and a tribute to a man who is a true master of the game of politics. Few politicians could have prevailed against the headwinds bearing down upon him. A mobilized and highly motivated opposition. The monetary windfall of campaign riches made possible by the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling and the candidacy of an exceedingly wealthy and utterly ruthless opponent, Mitt Romney. Despite occasional setbacks, few politicians, black or white, have had careers so blessed. But the conditions of black Americans could hardly be called blessed. By all the measurements by which we rank life, blacks rank at the bottom, where life is a nightmare. Health, education, employment, life expectancy, mortality, incarceration, you name it. The figures betray a life at the margins, lives at the bottom. Moreover, it is unrealistic to expect any change for the better in 4 years, no matter who is president nor what color he is. Them's the facts. It is a great and remarkable symbol that a black person is elected and re-elected to the presidency. It is a dazzling spectacle, yet it remains a spectacle. The lives of everyday black folk are just as grim as they were 4 years ago. They still must seek a way out of the prison keep that is America. A new dark-skinned warden doesn't change that. Education will still be a dizzying maze for millions of children. Who leave school bitter and uneducated. The police are a repressive presence all day long, making life unbearable. And behind it all stands what legal scholar Michelle Alexander calls the new Jim Crow, a system of oppressive containment on a scale that the world has never seen. A one-day celebration and 4 more years of hell. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Thank you. the handover. Now I sight them this step to drop the uniform. Go for Agada, so take cover them boot.
big thief. I go tell you now.
Are listening to Dias Folk Music on Uhuru. This is the Uhuru Radio Network. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond, speaking to you from Southern California. We have been listening to the music of Seyoun Kuti and Egypt 80. And Seyoun Kuti is Fela Kuti's youngest son. He has another son called Femi and Femi Kuti, and they both are fine musicians. And Seyoun is the youngest and quite good. He did a song called Africa, African Soldiers, Mr. Big Thief. And we also heard from Tekin Jah Fole, African Revolution. And Tekin Jah Poulet is from the Côte d'Ivoire, the so-called Ivory Coast, and we will be playing more from him and the Kutis, Fela, Femi, and Seon. We are big fans of the Kuti family at Uhuru Radio. And we're going to be speaking with Izili Danto momentarily. Later on, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn. And Melba Liston, who is no longer in the land of the living, was born in Kansas City, and she grew up in Los Angeles, California. And she joined the ancestors, I think in 1999, but she was a woman, a great trombone player and an arranger. She worked closely with Randy Weston. And we're going to listen to Ms. Liston work out with Quincy Jones's band, and she's going to be playing a song called My Reverie. And this is a woman who can handle the trombone. This is our sister, Melba Liston. Thank you. and you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. We were listening to the music of Melba Lipston, who is no longer in the land of the living. She worked very closely with Randy Weston. She also went to the she taught at the University of the West Indies in Kingston, Jamaica, and she worked with Motown. She worked with Quincy Jones, and she is missed. And joining us on the line from New York City is Ezili. Ms. Danto is with the Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network, and she's also an artist. We have seen her in concert in performance in Toronto, Canada. And how are you doing, Ms. Danto?
I'm fine, thank you.
I wanted to talk to you about a number of things. First, we wanted to talk about the earthquake, third anniversary of the earthquake in Haiti. There have been many earthquakes in Haiti, but we want to talk about the one that took place 3 years ago. I also wanted to discuss with you the fact that Al Prentice Bunchy Carter, the head of the Los Angeles Black Panther Party, was a student of Dessalines. Then I wanted to talk about women and the Haitian Revolution. And then we wanted to talk about some of your ideas about moving forward. But I guess the first thing we wanted to discuss is the earthquake, which took place 3 years ago, and the aftermath of the earthquake, what has taken place or what has taken place since the earthquake.
Right. Well, even before the earthquake, we were under occupation. So folks really must understand that. And there were about 10,000 UN troops acting as proxy for the U.S. military occupation of Haiti. And so when the earthquake happened on January 12, 2010, you had all of these troops, UN troops, in Haiti at all of the various hamlets and regions in Haiti. But obviously, the fact of the matter is they are not in Haiti to protect the Haitian people because, you know, you do not see thousands of those folks rushing to Port-au-Prince and lifting up the concrete and the steel off of the heads of the Haitian people. In fact, some of CNN folks caught the UN just, you know, they did sustain about 100, 125 folks in their headquarters who perished. But most of the folks were outside of that, and there was no help for Haiti, really, truly. Essentially, there was a lot of great people from America who saw the horrific pictures, and I think, you know, one out of every two, I mean, it was just a humongous number of human beings and individuals who sympathize and empathize and send money to the non-governmental organizations like Red Cross and so forth. But most of that money, as the New York Times recently just said, did not leave a footprint in Haiti. There are 400,000 Haitians still homeless. A lot of the money is still in the banks of these non-governmental organizations, and that which has been used has not been used in, you know, with the Haitian government. It's not been used with the Haitian people. Each of the charities have used it in the ways that they feel like using it. And there is no footprint in Haiti. And the people really feel like there's been an embezzlement, a misery. Their misery is used to buy foreign products, foreign goods, like, you know, bottled water and so forth. So essentially, I always like to take this time, really, to tell people that U.S. aid is not about helping Haiti. U.S. aid is about providing money to the U.S. corporations to buy U.S. products. That's basically what it's about. 98% of the money stays in Washington, Toronto, and Paris. So let's put that aside and look at the people of Haiti and where we are as a people. 7.5 billion, they say, have been dispersed since the 3 years. And where we are as a people is that the use of this trauma is what folks need to concentrate on. The use of this trauma to further dominate Haiti, to further destroy the population and black development, black culture, black life. That's what it's all about, and that's really what people should concentrate on.
Could I ask you one thing about the a couple of countries are involved in this, not just the U.S., but Canada and France. Could you talk about the role that Canada and France are playing? Because it seems like Canada is really getting the pass.
Exactly. It's sort of the triumvirate, the three northern Euro settlers with a significant history in Haiti. And, of course, Canada is lately into it as it tries to ingratiate itself into, U.S. superpower good graces. And also, mining companies have a nice home in Canada because of its better, environmental, mining companies, whenever they get in trouble in Africa, they'll just, reorganize and go organize somewhere in Canada. So there are many, many mining companies out of Haiti that are in Haiti right now from Canada, but they're really rehashed U.S. corporations. It's a global world with these global repugnant elites coming from everywhere, France, Canada, U.S., to essentially, folks must understand, the U.S. occupation in Haiti is a war of resources.
And resources.
So, resources, a war of resources, and it's the scam is that this is humanitarian aid, but that is a scam. What it is behind this humanitarian aid, since 2004, they've been carting out our iridium, our coltan, and our gold and oil. So the white saviors, the leftists, the white liberals, they don't open their mouth to talk about that because then they wouldn't have a job. So Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network is the one that have consistently been trying to explain to folks what is going on in Haiti is not different than what is going on in the Congo. So, for instance, they finally said after 9 years of denying it about Haiti's gold. So right now, if you can just Google it, Haiti's gold is, they say, one of the largest cachet in the Western Hemisphere, $20 billion worth of gold, and it's being mined by Canadian companies. And as I said, you know what that means. And they're doing open pit mining. Now, that is the worst sort of mining where they've used lead and arsenic and all sorts of things that leave a horrendous environmental devastation. And they're doing
so
that in time of cholera.
Pardon me. So it's not... It's detrimental to the environment as well as to the workers who work those places are really, they're taking their lives at risk, or their lives are at risk doing their work.
Precisely. And so they have to cover it up by saying Haiti's poor, because they're taking all of Haiti's resources, and then they can cover it up by keeping the people in oppressed, marginalizing them with this humanitarian troops that are on there. Now, what made it worse is that after the earthquake, 7 months after, in October 2010, the UN brought in some soldiers who had cholera, the most virulent form of cholera from Nepal, did not screen them medically, and they ended up dumping their raw feces into one of the largest rivers in Haiti, and right now, 2 years later, 8,000 Haitians have died. Now, this is on top of over 300,000 Haitians dead in 33 seconds in the largest, most worst disaster in terms of death in less than half a minute. So right now we have 8,000 Haitians dead from UN imported cholera and over 620,000 Haitians who have gone to the hospital with infections of cholera. So Canada was very, very pivotal. One of the ways of branding tyranny right now is to use the reputation of a country that may have had like a progressive reputation of being, out of wars, not warmonger. Well, they use that with Canada. Canada hosted something called the Ottawa Initiative right before the 2004 kidnapping of President Aristide. Your folks should know I was a lawyer for President Aristide at some point when he first came back in 1995, I think, 1994, the first time he went back, the first coup d'etat when he went back. Canada hosted this thing called the Ottawa Initiative, where they got together with the foreign ministers of all the countries in the West and decided that Haiti had to be occupied. and that they could not allow President Aristide in democratic rule of Haiti, because then that would hurt the corporate profit over people mentality of the unfettered capitalists who knew of Haiti's resources and felt that black people's resources should not be left in the hands of black people. It should be left in the hands, of course, of the, you know, the global elite for them to steal. And so Canada is very, very pivotal in what's going on in Haiti. And it has been from the beginning. It hosted the Ottawa Initiative. I can't, you know, go through all the details. And then in that Ottawa Initiative, basically what it said was that by 2020, Haiti would have something like over 20 million people. Right now, Haiti has 10 million people. And they said then that would be dangerous to, I guess, you know, white supremacist domination. I'm not sure. Folks can go read the documentation. It's on our website at esleydantal.com. And then France, the interest in this, you know, triumvirate, this amazing aggression against a country without even an army is, you know, folks say and point to the fact that President Aristide had asked for the independence debt back from France. As your audience knows, France was the colonizers of Haiti before my ancestors beat them in combat and became the first nation of enslaved people in the world to beat their aggressors and not choose the aggressor's language, the aggressor's religion, the aggressor's philosophy of life. We don't do bourgeois philosophy, bourgeois democracy in Haiti. I mean, the people have been struggling for over 200 years now to try to bring into application what they wanted to do for the Haitian Revolution, which is for the country to be equitably shared by all of its citizens, not just this 1% owning 98% of the wealth, as it is with the Europeans. So the independence debt that President Aristide asked for was at that time in 2004, $22 billion, which France had forced Haiti to pay back. What that means is that we were enslaved for almost 300 years by the Europeans, first the Spanish for 100 and then the French for 300. But when Haiti won its independence in 1804, France could not allow or kept coming back with cannons. And once the white tribes had a rapprochement upon themselves because they were fighting against each other, Jefferson got the Louisiana Purchase as a result of the war where the African warriors kicked the French out of Haiti, and therefore, you know, Napoleon didn't have a platform. But the point is that the Louisiana Territory in America, which was, you know, French territory in what is now the United States, was about made about 15 states altogether for the U.S. But that was sold to Jefferson, President Jefferson, after Haiti won its independence in 1804 by Napoleon for $15 million. Now listen. France. France paid forced Haiti to pay. Now, for the Louisiana Territory, which was half the size of the U.S., and Haiti is about maybe the size of the smallest, like Rhode Island. Haiti was forced to pay 106. That's 10 times the amount that Jefferson paid for the Louisiana Territory. Haiti was paid to pay $150 million. Now, this is after we won in combat. All of the European white tribes got together and said, you know, the only reason you can stand as an independent nation is if you pay France back for it losing my grand as property. So from 1820 to like 1947, that is the independence debt. And President Aristide, when he came into office and he was embargoed and ostracized by the Europeans, he said, you know, we want this independence debt back, and that is one of the reasons why France, you know, also was, you know, so offended And they've always thought that Haiti was their property anyways, because they came back in 1806 after the death of Dessalines and brought back and came back through ecclesiastic colonialism and by doing our education, by making French the national language when everyone speaks Creole, but the educated folks that always feel they were more Eurocentric than African. So we have a situation where France, Canada, and the United States came together in 2004 to do this coup d'etat. But what's really significant about it, and the reason that we stand at the Haitian Lawyers Leadership against all of this, and my name is Danton, is because 2004 was the 200th, would have marked the 200th anniversary of Haiti's bicentennial, and they wanted to make a point that you cannot be free with a freely elected president without without us being involved. And so they all came, you know, the rabbit elites came, and it has been one tyranny after the other, whether it's before the earthquake or after the earthquake with the UN cholera, or whether it's with the taking, you know, $7.5 billion in misery from Haitians in order to, you know, live their lives and defray from the economic world depression going on. Anybody who wants, any white folk or black northerner collaborator who wants, you know, a job right now can just go and make out a grant and say they're going to help some orphanage or whatever in Haiti, and they have their living expenses paid while the Haitian people continue to suffer, because the scam is that they're humanitarians. But a reality is it's the warmongering North taking out Haiti's resources, devastating the environment, and thinning out the population.
Ezili, could I? We have 15 minutes left, 14 minutes left, and I wanted you to complete that thought. But then we wanted to go. I wanted you to talk about women in the Haitian Revolution, and also I wanted to tell you some stuff about Al Prentice Bunchy Carter and his relationship to Dessalines. But I hope I didn't cut you off.
No. How many minutes do you say we have?
Yeah, about 14 minutes now.
14 minutes, okay. And you want to talk about the women of the Haitian Revolution?
Yeah, because I heard you in Toronto, and many of us read C.L.R. James' book, Black Jacobins, which he wrote in 1938, and that was a breakthrough book in terms of the Haitian Revolution. But one of the things that we realized was that when we read that book, we only heard about Toussaint Louverture, Dessalines, and Christophe, and, you know, for whatever reason, CLR didn't talk about any the role that the women played that much. But when I heard you in Toronto, you talked about Dessalines' mother and the role that women had played in the Haitian Revolution, and I would like for you to share that with the listening audience.
Absolutely. Well, you know, paternalism, racism, all of that deals with why women are erased in civil rights history in America or in the Haitian Revolution. So I have a piece, since we don't have much time, I would urge folks to go to our website, ezilidanto.com. We have, we are a people of struggle from the womb to the tomb. And because we struggle is the reason why my voice can be heard today. Because this voice was paid for in realms and reams of blood. And black women in Haiti took up guns, rifles, and fought for the liberty and the respect of the children that would fall, you know, down their thighs. And Haiti is significant in so many, many ways. It is sort of the symbolic representation of the defiled black woman since the Europeans came out of their cave and found out there were other people in the world who were different than them, and they used their violence and their religion to destroy and commit genocide and build societies on genocide. Well, you know, in 1791, when the Haitian Revolution began, and the reason my name is Ezelie Danta, it is the name of the Haitian divine archetype, the African divine archetype, that is the symbolic representation of generosity, love, beauty to the Africans who became Haitians in the land of the Taino. And this name that they gave to this energy, and this is not a human being. We don't domesticate God or the divine by giving it a face. It is a energy of, like I said, generosity, nurturing. If you look at Isis with the child, or if you look at the icon that's used by the Christian church with the mother that's nursing the child, that is the physical representation of what has become, what is Ezelie Danta, is that's the physical representation of it by the Christians, by the Egyptians, and so forth. But for the Haitian, it is something that they draw with their bodies. It's a heart with a dagger going through it. So that's the mother. That's the mother who's been betrayed. That's the mother who herself cuts out evil with good, which is the representation. It's called a veva in Haitian spirituality, and it is the representation of love. It's the representation of generosity, beauty, fertility, and womanhood. And that's Ezelie Danta. And on August 14, 1791, that was the predominant energy that motivated the warriors on a hilltop to begin the Haitian Revolution. This energy of protection, of mothering, is the energy that came out, and the historical figure of that who spoke for this energy, her name is Cécile Fatima. She was a Vodou priestess. And so that's one in terms of Haitian, how the Haitian Revolution began. You will probably read in C.L.R. James that it began with this woman standing with warriors and maroons. I mean, folks who had fought for their liberty for years and years and years, and she was the presiding warrior.
Fatima was her name?
Cécile Fatima.
Many Haitians came from, I guess, Benin, or what was called Dahomey, is that correct?
Well, many Haitians came from all of West Africa, Benin, and all the way down to Angola and the Congo. So we came not only from the West Africa and Dahomey, but also the Congo. And Vodun is the legend is 21 nations stood, and 21 nations they were talking about, not just nations in terms of geographical territory of places in Africa, but you're talking about a spiritual nation. And then that spiritual nation covered many, many geographical places in Haiti and in Africa. It's like I said, the Angola, all the way down to Angola. Yeah, Congo and Angola. So Cécile Fatima, Bookman, Cécile Fatima, people have said that their names are Muslim. So you know that there was a war in Africa way before the Europeans came with the Arabs, a force assimilating. So whether the African had been converted as a Muslim or converted as a Christian or whatever, at Bwakaima on August 14, 1791, they all went back to the mother religion of Africa, Vodun. They all stood up. They all stood up and bowed to Ezelie Danta, which came through the historical figure of Cécile Fatima. And just like you see Isis with the back in the day, you know, when women were divinely elevated as mothers and warriors before patriarchy took hold centuries ago, it was the woman that would decide who of her sons would become the king, the prince.
Mm-hmm.
So in the same manner, Edouard Kaima, Ezri Dantar chose who would lead the Haitian Revolution amongst the 200 warriors who were present at that very secret meeting. And she picked a man called Boukman. And that's how the Haitian Revolution began. And Ezri Dantar is known as the mother of the revolution, as the inspirer, and so forth. So that's the first, these two women. And then you have folks like, I'm just going to say their names so people can just look at it, because I don't know how much time we have, but we have women who had their own, what do you call that? When you have like a group of warriors who follow you, you know, like
a platoon. Right.
Exactly. So Défilé, we have Marie-Jeanne, we have Sanit Belair. These are women who, I have a piece called Dessalines, which is Haiti's founding father, because as you were mentioning, folks always lift up Toussaint Louverture, because Toussaint Louverture's paradigm did not reach all the way to taking out all of slavery. He was going to put the people back into the plantations in order to pay back the in order to keep Haiti financially going. But Dessalines, who is Haiti's founding father, who is the guy who said, okay, so Toussaint stood for what Toussaint wanted was to be the black ruler of a French colony in Haiti, and so he that's what he stood for, and that is what is the paradigm. He was killed for that by the French. But then when Dessalines rose after his death, they really saw that the handwriting was on the wall and they had to delay black rule, independent nation. And to this day, Dessalines' ideology, which is that Haiti would be a black rule, independent nation, is what Haitians struggle towards. Right now you have Obama, for instance, you have at the U.S., you have Kagame over in, Rwanda. You have Museveni
Uganda,
and then you have Kabila in Congo. These guys, the way we look at it as Vodouists in Haiti, they are black collaborators whose only demand is that they share in the leadership and in the command of the white supremacist system. They're not about changing it. They just want leadership and command and to be part of it. Jean-Jacques Dessalines did not want to be, you know, like Toussaint Louverture, get leadership and command and become, you know, a satellite of France. He wanted a black rule, independent nation where the people could decide, Creole is my language, Vodun is my spirituality, and this is my culture, and I am African, and I want to live in peaceful coexistence with you, but you will not dominate me. That is what Haitians right now, the reason why you have Obama sending 20,000 troops when Haitians were crushed under steel and rubble and the whole place had fallen down, is because they did not want the folks to take down their occupation and stop their resource wars. He didn't send those 20,000 troops to help lift up concrete and save lives. Now that's why you have this army of NGOs to fool the good American people and the good folks in France and the good folks in, you know, this is about humanitarian aid in Canada. Yeah, so essentially, what we're living is this these black collaborators, you know, like I said, they all, what they want out of, you know, modern society is that they get command and leadership and be part of this profit over people vampire system. And so they're all over, and this Toussaint Louverture, and I'm sure Toussaint Louverture probably didn't even see all the significance. He just thought that that's the most he could do because he was educated into this European system and figured, you know, the most I can do is become a ruler of Haiti, and Haiti will be a colony. But Dessalines came and said, no, We will be a Blackfoot independent nation. We will take the names and honor the Tainos and take the and name this nation IET, the name that came before, the land of my homeland. And the women like Marie Jeanne, the women like Sanie Belair, for instance, just to give you, I'll give you two, Sanie Belair and Défilé. Défilé, like I said, she was a sort of like, she gave resources and supplies to the troops. She followed the troops, but she also had her own troops. You have Glenn Guillotin, who was a spiritual advisor to Jean-Jacques Dessalines. He didn't go to war without going to Glenn Guillotin. Glenn Guillotin means was a Haitian Vaudouist priest. She told him, for instance, the day that he died, not to go south to Pétion, to see Pétion, that this would be the day of his death. But he did not listen to her, and he died. There's a great story of Glenn Guillotin. Those of you who, I think I have photos of her monument in Haiti. If you go to my personal page on Facebook, go to my public page of Esli Danton, you'll see we just recently sponsored four Haitian market women to go to India to learn how to be solar engineers, and in that process we brought them to see Haitian culture, and we brought them to the monument of Glenn Guillotin. Now that's a story I can't tell because I don't have the time, but Défilé, for instance,
I wanted to say that I'm very sorry, but we're gonna have to bring you back. But I wanted to say that I wanted to say one thing and then let you give out your information, but I wanted to let you know that our printer, Spongy Carter, was very fond of Dessalines. Also, he was fond of...
Who did you say? What's the name?
Our printer, Spongy Carter, from the Black Panther Party in Los Angeles, and also his partner who died with him on January 17th, John Huggins, had a Kittitian background. His father, I think, was from St. Kitts. And there's a young man by the name of Linford. He's writing a book about Bunchy. But could you give out your information? Because we've basically run over time, but I wanted to let people know how they can get a hold of you.
Okay, yes. Thank you for having me. Thank you for listening. Our website is ezilidanto.com, and all of our recent information is at the same place, but just put /Zili, Z-I-L-I, so ezilidanto.com /Zili. You will get all of the newest writings. You can join the Esli Danton Network and help us tell the truth about Haiti. We have videos, we have lots of interviews like this one that you could listen to, and so forth. And we have a project of clean water and solar energy that we're trying to get financed. So those who are interested in you know, a Black rule independent nation and changing the paradigm where the profit over people in this world rule while the majority are just lingering in this sort of amazing economic slavery, come and let's talk and let's engage in how we can make a change.
All right, thank you very much, and we're going to continue with we're going to do our tribute to the Vibrations, a group out of Los Angeles, California, and thank you once again, Ezili.
Much obliged.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the international.